These are most winning series. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, good. You do have the regular book,
yes,
as well as the galleys, because there are a lot of typos in the galleys.
I enjoy those. I love reading the galleys and finding the typos in there.
The one thing that worried me was at the very end. I noticed on the last page they got. There's some sentences here that don't make any sense. And since the last page, the last paragraph of the story, I was worried that, you know, it would throw people out of the book at the very end. But
well, I have a feeling that as I read, I catch them if they're glaring, but I have a feeling people mentally block them out, and I don't think you notice.
Good. Well, you probably have had experience reading a lot of them, and I haven't. So that's
well, that's you're going to notice every one.
Yes, exactly.
It's going to be painfully. I've had writers who've come in with their books, and in the interview, they will say, "I have to make a few changes here," and they go through page so and so, and they make the changes. What's funny is how these errors pop up in subsequent printings. That should never happen, but it does. Because there's this classic example of the first edition of James Agee's Death in the Family. On page 80, I think the beginning of, I can't remember which chapter, the opening sentence is, "on walking in the morning," and of course it should be, "on waking in the morning." So if you ever run across a Death in the Family, you turn to page 80 and you'll find...
And they kept that error.
Subsequently, they corrected the error.
They did,
but in the first edition, they didn't catch it. Mm-hmm. So forever, the first edition will have "on walking in the morning." So if you ever see a Death in the Family, flip to that page and see if you can find it. You'll know you have a true first. Well, these are certainly winning stories. The thing that struck me, and maybe you could comment on this, is that the characters are all different. There is such a wide array. There's the priest who goes on the gambling junket. There's the soldier in... I'm not exactly sure where that was set. At first I thought it was set in Vietnam, and then I realized it couldn't be. It had to be set in a local army camp because he had the girlfriend, Mickey.
Fort Lewis, Washington.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't really... I understood that it was in the United States that this was happening. But I think I mentioned that there's an elm tree, a dead elm at the beginning, which is a tree found over here.
Well, it was pretty obvious after a bit that it was in the U.S. because obviously you're not going to have a girlfriend named Mickey. Is that her name,
right.
Mickey?
Right.
And then the
payphones.
Yeah, and then the confrontation in the driveway and all of that. It was obvious. I just got a little confused at one point. And there were a whole bunch of other interesting characters. The girl who retrieved the bicycle from the swimming pool, the shoplifter, and the one particular story, I can't remember all the titles, was the one that took place out on the desert where the young would-be musician had dropped off his family at the gas station while he goes to look for a spare part. So all of the characters, such a disparate number of characters, and I just wonder about that, because many writers tend to write about the same people over and over, but not you.
Well, I do in a way. All those characters are different manifestations of myself. They are all different parts of me that come to the fore in the writing of these different stories. My memory of myself as a teenage shoplifter entered strongly into the characterization of Gene in Coming Attractions, and then say the story you mentioned, Soldier's Joy, about this this career soldier in decline who can't put things together. That's really my nightmare of what I would have been if I had stayed in the Army, which I had once thought of doing. So every character in the book really is drawn on me.
There How about are, the Catholic priest?
That too. I once considered becoming a going into seminary, even perhaps into a monastery, and that's the kind of priest I'm afraid I would end up being. You can write about the person you might have ended up being if you had gone a certain direction. For example, I think Updike does that a lot in his Rabbit books. I think Rabbit is what Updike would have been if he'd stayed in Pennsylvania and and let his not exploit his intelligence and talent. If he had let himself go the way Rabbit kind of let himself go, though obviously Rabbit is not as gifted as Updike, he nevertheless is just a vast treasury of observation and kind of theological musings that go on in that man's head. I mean, he's a very complicated character. And
that's very perceptive, because Updike told me that the Rabbit is enough like him that, but yet different enough that he is an interesting character who has been in three books so far and is very likely to be in a fourth.
Hmm.
Different levels and plateaus of his existence, which coincide with Updike's. That is interesting about the Catholic priest, who is a loser, really. But I just wonder if you, matter of fact, and perhaps as we talk, we are talking about losers, aren't we? In many respects, we're talking about the musician, the would-be musician, heading to stay with his, I guess, his brother, or brother in Los Angeles. He seems as though he's a loser. The career soldier, Soldier's Joy, seems, I don't know about him.
Well, the word loser is, for me, I mean, that I suppose is one way of characterizing some of the people in these stories. I certainly don't think that's true of all of them.
Nor do I think it's true of you. And I want to clarify that.
Oh, no.
That these are different manifestations of yourself, as you assert this.
No. Exactly. And that, I think, I mean, a loser to me, when I think of a loser, I don't think of someone necessarily who's fallen on hard circumstances or whose possibilities are getting shut off, but of somebody really without inner resources at all. Without imagination, without any possibility of redeeming themselves, and I don't think of my characters as in that way at all. It seems to me, for example, that Father Leo is on his way to finding him, connecting himself with himself in a way he hasn't before, and knowing who he. When he says, "It's okay, I'm here," at the end, when he says, "I'm here," that's something he couldn't have said before in that story. I think that he could say in a reassuring way to somebody, "I'm here," that he has that much self-esteem in a way, or emotion toward self-esteem in the story, that he isn't a loser to me. Jean is not a loser. In fact, I think she she seems to me to be a heroic person, given her circumstances.
Jean is
the one who pulls the bicycle yeah. out of the swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see my characters as losers. I see them as tested by their own characters and by the situations they're put in, but not succumbing. Mark in Desert Breakdown, the story you mentioned about the fellow who leaves his wife in the and baby in the gas station in the middle of the desert while he goes off searching for a part, he seems to be somebody who is destined to destroy himself. He is, I guess, he comes as close to anyone in the story, in any of these stories, to be what you might call a loser, because I think he's going to lose everything, but he's going to make his wife in the process into something much tougher and ferocious than she is, and so in a way she's going to gain in character and stature by what he's doing.
These stories, some of the stories, it seemed to me could easily be expanded into a longer story, such as a novel. I can't remember all the titles, but certainly the one about the Father Leo, mm-hmm. a very long story. That is one that I could easily see an elaboration of that story into a novel. Has that ever gone through your head to expand these stories in any way, or are you content with the short story?
Some of them I've toyed with the idea of expanding, but then I think, well, the world, I've suggested a whole world in here. I'm really, really pleased to have you say that you can imagine these going on, because that means that the world is real to you in the story, that you could see, you know, living in that world. But it's pleasing to me that I've managed to suggest that much in so short a space, because that's really what I'm trying to do with these stories. I haven't felt the necessity of continuing any of those stories. And that was that I would need to feel that to make a novel out of them, that I needed to go on and to tell the whole story. And it seems to me by the time I've reached the ends of these, the conclusions of these stories, that my work is done, that in a way the story might go on echoing in the reader's mind with, and the possibilities of what might happen after the story might go on operating on the reader.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, I've made that world real. I've made these people exist, and they have their own existence now, and they don't need me to continue them any longer. I think that if you're going to write a novel, it's not a decision you sort of arbitrarily make at one end of the writing, but it's something that should happen to you in the writing, that you're just pulled on in spite of yourself to the end of and you find yourself suddenly with a long. I've done that once with a book called The Barracks Thief, in the writing of the story, I found myself pulled on inexorably toward a much longer form than I'd imagined, and ended up with something about 100 pages long.
What do you do with a 100-page story?
It was published as a book.
As a book.
Mm-hmm. It was published in a magazine form first. It's a slim book, yes.
Yeah. Barry Hanna writes 96-page
right.
books. They're almost not books.
Ray is one of those, right.
Have you read, there's a very fine young writer from Canada named Guy Vanderhaeghe. Have you read his stuff yet?
No, I haven't.
It's just published in the United States. Tickner and Fields has published his volume, first book of short stories. It's in paperback, and I believe it's called Man Descending, and a novel, and I can't remember that title. Maybe I have them backwards. I read them both at the same time. The interesting, I'll ring it up, is that the short stories, there are two stories that concern an anti-hero of his named Ed, who is the anti-hero in his novel. So Ed makes his first appearance in two short stories, a very unattractive hero, to say the least. And Vanderhaeghe said that he couldn't get Ed out of his mind, and there was more to say about Ed, and he felt that he had to expand it. So that's exactly what he did. He took Ed out of two short stories, which logically would fit in with the novel. I mean, there seems to me no reason he couldn't have taken those two short stories and put them in ahead of the novel, because all the characters are cross-referenced. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Have you done that? Have you used characters, identical characters, and expanded them or transferred them to other stories?
No, I haven't. But I probably will someday. Some of the characters that I've written about, in my first book, for example, there's a young man who's very close to the young man I was, in a story called Smokers. And I'm almost certainly going to return to him and to his voice and go on with that. There are others that I could see, in, though I might change the names, the sort of essence of the character I might use again.
Let me ask you a few questions about yourself. There's some biographical data that the Felicity people sent me here. Born in Birmingham, Alabama, but you consider yourself
a
Southerner?
No. I probably should have left that off, not told anybody about that, because I've actually found myself identified in print as a Southern writer. We left Alabama when I was 6 months old. That was my experience in the South. I mean, what I know about the South, I know from the movies, you know.
Tell me a little bit about, you grew up in Washington.
Mm-hmm. State of Washington. Spent a lot of time in California. Mm-hmm. Utah, also grew up in Utah. Spent some time in Utah.
Did you grow up in a bookish family?
Inadvertently. They were, my mother and my stepfather of the time were, my mother was a reader of big fat novels by James Gould Cousin and Thomas B. Costain, and because where we lived there was no television, I got in the habit of reading these novels, and also a lot of Albert Payson Terhune and eventually Jack London, and then from Jack London to Ernest Hemingway. And so our isolation, we lived in a very small village in the Cascade Mountains. And the nearest high school was 32 miles away. It was very remote. Couldn't even beam a television signal up there. So we were really thrown on books a lot. And I'm sure that's where my impulse to be a writer began, was in reading constantly.
Mm-hmm. Did you do any writing as a youth?
Yeah, all the time. I used to write stories really pretty much from the age of 11 or 12 on. I wrote a lot of stories.
What was college like? Where'd you go to school?
Well, I was in the Army for 4 years, and then I went to Oxford University in England, did my undergraduate work there, and then did the kind of work that any young writer does to keep body and soul together, and waiting on tables and being a night watchman and teaching high school.
You studied English in college, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. With the intention of teaching or the intention of writing?
With the intention of writing. And fortuitously have ended up ultimately in the last 7 or 8 years teaching as well. In a way that I like. I teach young writers and people who are just beginning. And I remember myself the difficulty of that time. And so it's nice. It's good for me to be able to give somebody else the benefit of whatever experience I have at this point. It's going on. I'm not at the end of my experience. I'm still learning and changing. I consider myself a young writer, I'm not a scholar, and I'm not expected to be a scholar. Where I am, I'm just sort of expected to read the fiction of beginning writers and help them with it as best I can.
You're teaching at Syracuse.
That's right.
Do you find that the teaching cuts into your own work?
It has in the past. It doesn't anymore. I teach now just 4 months a year, and I write 8. And even in the 4 that I'm teaching, I still find time to write. So I really have nothing to complain about. I'm very considerate of. They're very glad to have a writer there, and they treat me very well and make a lot of time for me.
John Fowles was in for an interview with me a couple of weeks ago. He was highly critical. He also taught, but didn't want to teach.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to write, and he found that the teaching was bad for him. And so he doesn't have to. Of course, he's made enough money with the French attendant's woman that he can live on that comfortably for the rest of his life. But he was particularly critical of Americans. He says, American writers always congregate around college campuses. He says he would like to see writers work as dishwashers or anything other than anything having to do with writing.
That sounds like somebody who's never done it. I have. I did it for 5 years, and I can tell you that the dangers to writing are not on the campus. The dangers to writing are in people being worked so hard that they don't have any energy to write when they get home at night. I didn't write better because I was on my feet 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. I didn't write better because I was wondering all the time how I was going to get the money to pay the rent. And I didn't write better because worrying whether I'd ever be able to get married because I didn't have the money for it. Writing requires some freedom, space to dream. And however you can get that, you should be grateful for it as a writer. I would prefer not to teach at all. I would prefer to do as he does and just write. And until I make enough money to do that, which I hope someday to do, I'll go on teaching. But I'm very, very happy that I don't have to wash dishes anymore, which I've done. And for him to say that suggests to me that he hasn't, because it's terrible work, and it's demoralizing, and you lose faith in yourself after a while.
It seems to me also being able to have a teaching job gives you a place to hang your hat, gives you people to meet, gives you a sense of feeling that you belong someplace.
Yes, exactly. Writers need community as much as anybody does. And the other thing, too, England, the situation in England, where I lived for several years, is completely different from here. In London, you do know other writers. You have a built-in community. Now, if you lived in York, England, you wouldn't. If you lived almost anywhere else in England, you wouldn't. Maybe in Dublin there are enough writers to make a community. But the only place like that in this country that I know of is New York City. Maybe San Francisco. But otherwise, for writers to find themselves in community with other writers, just about the only place that can happen. is in this country is on a campus, and I that's where I've gotten to know all the writers I've gotten to know, and I've been really happy to get to know.
Well, you certainly take a different approach from Herbert Gold, who used to live here in New York, and he lives in San Francisco now.
Right, he was my next door neighbor there
in San Francisco.
Yes,
yeah, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Gold was telling me that there were too many writers in New York, and there was the publishing industry is here, and the magazines are here, and everything. Mm-hmm. He said if he went to his doctor, he said it was the same doctor who had just looked down William Styron's throat, and he said. He said he finally had to get away from all of these writers, and so he went out to San Francisco to try to adapt a story he had written for a stage play, and he was out there 2 weeks and liked it. So he had sublet his apartment in New York. He called the tenant, and he said, keep the apartment, keep the furniture. I'm staying in San Francisco. Gold is kind of like that. You tell me a little bit about your first book, In the Garden
of the North
American Martyrs. Tell me about that. How'd that come about?
It's a collection of stories I wrote over a period of several years. I threw out most of what I'd written in those years, and those stories seemed to me to form a kind of coherent whole. And so I put them together, and they were published. Most of them had been published anyway in different magazines by that time. The Atlantic and other magazines had published the stories. And it was did very well, especially for a collection of short stories. It was greatly exceeded everyone's expectations, including mine. So that was a wonderful start for me. And since then, I've published a short novel or novella called The Barracks Thief. Then this collection represents about 4 years worth of writing, this new collection, Back in the World. Again, I've discarded a lot of stories that I've written and published in order to come up with something that hangs together, that is of a piece, say, the way Joyce's collection, Dubliners, is very much of a piece, and there's a kind of coherence to the whole collection, even to the arrangement of the stories. And so that's where I am now.
Well, they're certainly wonderful stories, Tobias Wolff. This was a wonderful introduction for me to your work. I had heard about you a lot, and this was a terrific opportunity for me to be able to meet you and talk to you, and I wanted to. And matter of fact, I came in especially to talk to you, and another writer's coming in later today named William Murray. I don't know if you know Bill's stuff. He writes for The New Yorker, and he's been focusing on mysteries, so he's very good.
Oh.
So these were wonderful stories. I wish you the best with them. I'm going to be anxious to read more from you. I'll be looking for your name every place I can find it. And I thank you very much for
coming
in and talking to me.